Our conversation with Deanna David is made possible by the Embroiderers Guild of America at egausa.org. Three things to do. One, if you're not an EGA member, consider joining either through a local guild or as a member at large. Two, visit egausa.org and register for the 2025 National Seminar. If you're not a member but want to experience a national seminar, sign up for Sampler University, which involves 2 days at the national seminar and two terrific projects. Three, sign up for the next virtual lecture, an introduction to early medieval embroidery in England with Dr. Alexandra Macon. Registration opens October 21, and the Zoom lecture is November 9, 2024 at 1 p.m. Eastern. EGA will take your needlework to new heights. Join today at egausa.org. Thanks to the Embroiderers Guild of America for sponsoring the show. And now our conversation with Deanna David of Ribbon Candy Hooking. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week from Ribbon Candy Hooking, Deanna David. Deanna, welcome.
Great. Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
You are one of those many examples where textile arts, needlework, whatever you want it, you know, whatever label you want to put on it, kept you sane during some stressful times in Europe there. That was an interesting story. You needed something.
Absolutely. You know, one of the sort of commonalities when you talk to people who get involved in rug hooking, and I'm sure it can be, you know, it can also be said for knitters and quilters and other textile people, but more for rug hookers, I hear so often that people are struggling with depression or some kind of profound problem. And they find this craft because it's so repetitive and thus meditative, but it is not a craft that requires concentration, right? Like if you're knitting and you screw it up, you really screw it up. When you're rug hooking, if you screw it up, you just go back a few loops and it's easily undone and you don't have to cry yourself to sleep. It all works out. It's a very easy entry level craft. And historically, rug hooking was used after World War I and World War II for soldiers who are recovering from horrific things because it keeps your mind occupied in a sort of mathematical way, but without the math. So it's a great craft to come to if you like it when your hands are busy and you're being productive, but you don't necessarily like to have to be mentally engaged because you like to watch your shows or you're half talking to your family, you know?
Yeah. So tell that story so people know it. You were living in Europe and
yeah, I was living in Europe for a long time. I'm an American, but I was born in the Netherlands, and I ended up marrying a Dutch man and having both of my children in Amsterdam. And you know, it was a wonderful and fun novelty for quite a while. But after a while, the sort of shine wore off, and I became super depressed and very, very homesick. And there was really nothing for me other than to get more and more miserable. So I started to try to help myself by finding crafts that I thought were linked to New England so that in that way I could connect to my past, mm-hmm. my family, my cultural heritage. And, you know, quilting is great, but it's not necessarily like a New England craft. And the only one that I found was rug hooking. Which can be tied to either very northern New England around the 1860s or, you know, Canada, right up in that region. And I thought, oh, this is a textile thing, so I will be good at it because I know how to do everything else with fabric. But it's not something I've tried yet. So that winter I asked my mom, she said, you know, what do you want me to send over for Christmas? And I said, send me a rug hooking kit with one of those little frames and all the parts and let me see how it goes. And she sent it over, and I ended up hooking this maple leaf in one day, and it's awful. I did everything wrong. But in terms of the aesthetic, it struck me as being quite beautiful. All of that fabric controlled like a tapestry. And I thought, oh, interesting, because I think probably like you or like most people, when you hear rug hooking, you think, are you making a rug? Right? There's a problem with language with this craft. Nobody really is making a rug. A handful of people are actually making rugs, but how many rugs does one need? So most of us are making something that's more akin to a tapestry in small pieces for the table. And once I realized, and I tried it for myself, that it was something that was scalable, could be a rug for, a Gilded Age mansion, but it could also be something for to put a candle on top of the table at Thanksgiving. It was a great find, and it really saved me at that time.
It's, I mean, it's so cool because we've through the years so many stories where that kind of thing has happened for one reason or another, just mentally gave you a safe space to go to and just get the tension out of you. And
Absolutely. And it's the kind of a craft, just the nature of it. And I'm sure many fiber arts work the same way. But with rug hooking, you can be either a very technical person. And in that case, maybe your goal and your comfort zone is I do things very technically. I like it when my loops are very even. I like it when I produce something that looks like it was manufactured. I like perfection. I'm technical. But then there's people like me who are like, I'm not technical at all. If it looks wild and crazy, if it looks unmanicured and eccentric and eclectic, that's my comfort zone. And then there's everybody in the middle. So this is a craft where you can really dig in and make it your own, whether you are a wild and crazy person or you are someone who is much more sort of black and white, super technical, and you're not happy unless you can achieve perfection, right? Both of those things are possible with this craft. And in that way, I think it's a really unusual sort of asset or feature to the craft is that both things are possible, but also in the same piece, or one day you could do a piece that's like photorealism, super technical, 30 shades of green in one leaf. And the next day you could go completely nuts and do something bonkers and cartoony, So it's got that great range.
See, you and I are at the opposite ends of the spectrum. I'm that perfectionist person, and I have to, but I have to work at that to convince myself that it's okay if that particular stitch isn't quite right, because when I take the magnifier away, you can't tell. And so, I have to tell myself, let it go, just let it go, and move on and enjoy the process of the stitching, or it doesn't matter what it is, but yeah, for me, that's hard. That's a hard thing to do.
Absolutely. But Gary, the thing is, when you are a technical person, it's good to own it and it's good to know it. Because as
Oh, I
soon as
know
you
it. I
as soon
know
as you
it.
creep out of that comfort zone, you are uncomfortable with your technique, with the way that you're working and with what you're producing. So there's no, as far as teaching and reaching people for this craft, historically, at least through the 20th century, rug hooking has been taught in a very technical way. And for that reason, I think it alienated a lot of people who were more creative types, with very rigid rules, And now we're finally, the pendulum swung, and we're finally back in the center where people are starting to say out loud, it's okay if you're technical. You should work in that way. Do it the way that you like it. Why waste time doing something that you're not enjoying the process and you're not happy with the result? But if you are not technical, you are still 100% doing it right. It's taken 150 years in this craft for people to say, it's okay to do it the other way too.
Yeah, it's so interesting because you have rug hooking and then you do punch needle, and I tried that once. I gave it a hard try. I just couldn't. I just couldn't cooperate with it. And then we have that latch hooking thing that happened, what, back in the 70s or whenever that was. But all three similar in a way, but different. But the punch needle and the rug hooking really are kind of sisters, if you will, in terms of technique.
Yep, absolutely. They're all three related, right? They're all three crafts where you are making a rug or tapestry and you're holding a hook or something, a tool in your hand. You are not working on a loom. So in that regard, it's all the same. They're all rug making and handheld tool. So punch needle, rug hooking goes back to the 1860s. Punch needle is almost as old. I mean, it's right in there. The first patents for punch needles were the 1890s. And the punch needle is a little bit different. It was built for speed. When you are rug hook, I don't have a punch needle in front of me, but when you are rug hooking, right, this is a rug hooking tool, and this used to come in the form of a piece of wood that you whittled down so it was comfortable in your hand, however you hold it, right? It was comfortable. And a nail that was bent, right, over the fire.
Oh, that was
And
the original, was just a
that's
nail?
the original. I mean, we're so spoiled now with every kind of tool, every kind of shape, every kind of shaft, every length of tool, every shape of handle. But back in the day, piece of wood with a bent nail. And with rug hooking, we're literally punching down through a backing, putting the fiber, whether it's yarn or wool strips or whatever, into the crook of the needle, like crochet, and pulling it up to the surface, making a loop. Whether they're high hoops, sometimes we say people are high hookers. There's lots of jokes here, of course. Low hookers, all kinds
Oh
of
yeah, I'm restraining because there's
hookers.
all kinds that we can
Tempting,
do
isn't
there.
it? Tempting. But this is a slightly older craft, and it's quite, I'm not going to say it's quite slow. It really depends on how you work, right? I'm quite fast. But punch needle was invented like maybe 30 years later, and the idea with punch needle is you're not working on the front pulling up loops, you're working on the reverse of your backing and you're pushing down loops, so you're not seeing your work as it evolves. And for some people that's way out of their comfort zone, because you've got to keep peeling it off the frame and going, are the for you, Gary, are the loops even, right?
And there's where
For
I
you,
had trouble.
there, right? So no, that wouldn't be for you because you can't see as you go along. It's very different. But with punch needle, it can be great. You can get some detail. I don't feel you can get as much as you can with the hook, but you can get great detail, and you get much more speed with punch needle, right? But at the end of the day, if you love this craft, you should do both, because one of them is pulling up and one of them is pushing down. And of course, that repetitive motion of any kind is going to play on your hand and your wrist, and you're going to have problems. So it is good to kind of put both tools into your bag of tricks so that ergonomically you've got choices, right? Instead of
Excellent, excellent. So I'm tired this way, I'll go the other way. Okay, I like that.
Exactly. Yep, why not? And latch hook is a little different again. Latch hook is an interesting one because latch hook is the product of commercialism. It's a much earlier tool than the 1970s. It's more of a 1940s tool. But it became very commercial, and companies in the 1970s started to produce that pre-cut yarn. It was always acrylic. And the tool was exactly the same as a rug hook, but it had a toggle. So you would essentially create a knot and pull it up, and it would be a kind of tufted two-piece top to it, which created a cut pile as opposed to a looped pile, which is most traditional with rug hooking. I think the problem with the reason that latch hook languished and died out the way that it did was because of the designs of latch hook and the quality of the fiber. They were both. It was
Really
low quality
lacking.
fiber, and and design-wise, it was of the time, but it wasn't super, they aren't super charming unless you're a great vintage lover of that specific vintage. It's not for everybody, but it is worth saying that if you love latch hook, that backing is different than what rug hookers use, and latch hookers don't need to use a frame. You can put a piece of latch hook backing, which is a much stiffer, more open gauge, right on the table or on your lap, no frame, no expensive tools, and latch it. And if you throw away all of those crappy pre-cut acrylics, which sometimes they're good for fillers, but if you want to use your yarn from the yarn store, if you want to use your sock yarn, your lace yarn, your worsted, your bulky, you can use that and create a phenomenally interesting, high quality gallery piece doing latch hook.
I found that interesting that out of that latch hook thing, that the backing, you speak highly of that, that like that is get some of that and use it, that it's so out of that whole kind of phase of a thing, because oh, I remember those things, and everybody was doing them and buying those little circle things of pre-cut acrylic yarn. Yes. Oh man, and just and I never got it because it didn't appeal to me, number one. But yeah, the designs to me were like, oh no, thanks, I'll pass.
Yeah. Gary, maybe you didn't like unicorns or mushrooms.
No, neither. So the backing out of that comes this backing that is for rug hooking is really excellent then.
Rug hooking, traditional rug hooking like this, you're going to want you're going to want a fabric backing.
Okay.
Typically, traditionally it's burlap, but we have learned over the years that burlap rots easily. So that's why we've lost so many of the 19th century rugs. If you're not putting your rug on the floor, burlap is still great. And in the UK, burlap is still great. In most of Canada, they're still using burlap. Americans have become very elite in their tools. And that's part of what has made it a really prohibitive craft is the supplies are too expensive. So if you want to go for that super high quality, you know, hairless linen or 100% cotton's monk's cloth, which is different than the embroidery monk's cloth. It's not the needle one. It's just rug hooking. Or rug warp, which is 100% cotton. Then you're able to have sort of more range for rug hooking. The reason I keep talking about latch hook backing is specifically because I love crossover and I love inclusion. And I know that there's a big group of people out there who want to come to the craft, but they've priced out the rug hooking supplies and they've gotten sticker shock. So I like to be there for those people and say, listen, do you do the big box store? Is that where you want to get your stuff? Because if so, get latch hook backing, still use a rug hook or a crochet hook, like I would say number 3 or number 3.5, and you can still rug hook into latch hook backing. You're not going to get the same detail that I would get in a fabric backing because the weave is so open and large, right? So it's very pixelated.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to consider that. But hey, if you're doing abstracts or you're doing something vintagey and you're not looking for that extreme detail, that's a great backing. You don't need a frame. You don't even need a specific rug hook. You can stick with the crochet hook. You can use all the same materials. You can cut up your t-shirts. You can cut up anything and put that through that latch hook backing. So that's there as an option.
Yeah. And that gets to the point that for folks who are listening to this, the video that's on your site, it's like 35 minutes or so. It is absolutely worth watching. I learned so much from it. Really, really excellent. But, and there's no but to this. I don't know why I said but one of the messages that comes out of that is so true for all kinds of textile art is you really emphasize to not get bogged down in expensive equipment, that you can approach this thing without a huge investment, see if you like it, and then work your way into gear. And, you know, I'm sitting here in a room that is just full of needlework gear that, you know, it's probably way over the top, but, you know, that's part of it. But I just thought that was so good that you emphasize that again and again in that video is keep it simple. Find out if you like it. I really applauded you for that.
Thank you. Well, this started out as a thrift craft. And as I said, it's gone very far, in my mind, in the wrong direction. Now, if you want to have a $1,500 cutter for your wool strips and you would like an $80 hook, and this is an $80 hook, sometimes I use it, but sometimes I use my crochet hook. If I'm watching a show and I don't want to stand up and the crochet hook is there, I'll reach for that instead. You don't need the super expensive stuff. And if it is a deal breaker, right, and you want to come to the craft, but you're afraid that you can't do it unless you mortgage your house and make yourself sick over what you spent, that you have to know that there's other ways to approach this craft. It's a thrift craft and it's for everybody. Some people always want the nicest and the best. We all do. But if you can't afford it, you start with other stuff and you might be surprised to find that you end with the stuff. You might try everything and empty your bank account out and end up with burlap and no hooking frame, right? Uh-huh. Even people like Claire Murray, who in the 80s, very important rug hooker, right? And she created this amazing sort of decorative brand and built an empire. To this day, she still hooks with no frame. She hooks by wrapping her backing material, which is burlap, around her lap. Oh. And she, I mean, I couldn't do it. My neck would not allow me to do that, but she has always done that. So nothing special for her. I mean, she definitely can afford all of these nice things. And I'm sure she tried them, but she landed on very basic tools. Mm-hmm. So it just goes to show, just because something is expensive doesn't mean that it's for you.
Yeah. 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 Oh, that was so good. And then now that we've learned that it started out with a bent nail, a chunk of wood, and some burlap, for crying out loud. That just about everybody can afford that in one form or another. And we can all bend a nail.
Should we all bend a nail?
Probably not.
But everybody's got, you know, this I've got a shirt right here that's on deck. It's like a jacket that would have fit me before I had my kids. And now I'm at peace with knowing I will never wear this jacket. So instead of throwing it out, I love it. I could give it to charity. But I really love it, and I'm going to cut it up with a pair of scissors, and I'm going to hook with it, and it's going to be probably one of the backgrounds of one of my upcoming pieces.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, I'm learning here. This is so much fun for me. So when my grandma was here in the world, one of the things she did was quilts, but she did the old fashioned quilts where she took old clothes that were worn out, cut them up, and made quilts. And I still have a couple of them, and some of them have pieces from old shirts that I wore. And you know, I treasure that. So the rug hooking then allows you to do that same thing with old clothing. So that jacket then is going to show up in a rug and have whatever memories it carries for you. Frustration Absolutely. That you can't wear it anymore or whatever it might be, but
part of the story. Part of the story, right? I put on a ton of weight. That's part of the story. But, you know, quilting is also a thrift craft, right? Mm-hmm. All of those little bits that you're talking about, your grandma, whether she was a piecing quilter or an applique quilter, she still was used to handling pieces, and she could get those pieces from any fiber, right?
Right.
And early quilts are many different kinds of materials. It's not the quilt store stuff, right? That's what we have now. Oh, I got to make a quilt. Got to go to the quilt store. I got to break the bank. But it's the same thing with rug hooking. You don't have to go to the rug hooking store. I mean, I have a rug hooking brand, so I would love it if you did go to the rug hooking store. But you don't have to go to the rug hooking store. You just cut your stuff up. And quilting, applique quilting, has in common also with rug hooking and lots of needle arts that all you need is a line drawing, right? People mm-hmm. tend to think quilting is very different than cross stitch or needlework or rug hooking. If we're talking about something that is based on a line drawing, we're basically talking about the exact same thing, but you might be holding a different tool in your hand.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting crossover, because sometimes I'll get like one of those work baskets, right? My grandmother had all of those work baskets. And once in a while, there's a pretty picture for maybe some crochet design or something like that. And I literally look at the squared grid, and I can translate that onto my backing as a rug hooker and make exactly the same thing, because it's just lines. Yeah. So we have that in common with quilters as well.
Yeah. It's interesting, the crossover. There's so much through all the needle arts, and one way or another, if you look for it, there's so much crossover and commonality. So take us through your overseas, your rug hooking, and now you have a business, designs, the whole shoot and match. Yep. Take us through that process. How do you go from this is keeping me sane to now it's my life?
Yeah. You know when something like this happens and there's a gap and you just don't know how you got there. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit of that. You know, we ended up moving back to the United States, and I was super relieved, but it didn't stop me from being depressed. Right. It turns out it wasn't locational. It's me. So I just brought my problems here. Yeah. But once we got here, my kids became old enough to go to school. And then I found myself, in 2019, I was a tour guide before I had the kids. So obviously I was not going to hit the road with two young ones, you know.
Yeah.
So I was kind of stuck with no identity. What am I going to do? I was already quite down. And for my New Year's resolution for January 1st, 2020, I said, you know what, why don't I start doing like a craft and try to start my own business, right? Because I'm at home. And so starting on January 1st, I started a Facebook group, got it going. It was very quickly 50 people. And the thing was, I had never really done anything but that one maple leaf. And, you know, I started practicing stuff as I went. Uh-huh. And on my channel, on my YouTube, I started recording videos. On my YouTube channel, I started to record how-to videos. This is just like me, before I really knew how to do it. And those videos,
you know, they tell you that the best way to learn something is to teach it. So there you go.
That's right. Well, you know, I realized there were a lot of people flocking to the channel because, you know, when you're learning something, if you learn it from someone who's been doing it for 40 years, they often forget to say that important little thing because they've been doing it for 40 years.
Right.
When I'm doing it, learning as I go, and I was transparent about saying, I'm figuring this out as I go, I didn't miss any of those little things. So it became very easy for people to watch me and go, oh, yeah. Because I wasn't missing anything. I was figuring it out as I went along. And then, of course, in March of that year, it was COVID.
Right.
And then I started doing live shows 5 times a week. You know, I wanted to be there and be chatting, and people were showing up, and then more people were showing up, and then lots of people were showing up. And I felt a little bit like a war profiteer or something like that, because it was like the worst of circumstances.
Right.
But on the plus side, I was there for a lot of people who were also feeling really down.
Yeah.
And we figured it out together. And during the next couple of years, I really formed a philosophy. I got really interested in the history of the craft. And I formed this philosophy, and I was able to identify in my mind, I see what's happened with rug hooking during the 20th century. There's a lot of precision. There's a heavy emphasis on the technical part of the craft. And there's kind of been a poo-poo at the people who do stuff that's a little bit more bohemian and loose. And I thought, you know what? Let's deal with that right here. Now that I have a platform, let's build a bridge between those two things. And once the word was kind of out there, you know, that I taught in that style, that I designed in that style, that I was a great cheerleader for people who do any kind of rug making, right?
Mm-hmm.
The channel became more and more popular, and my business grew really fast. And I was grateful for that. And I was grateful to bring the message that I think, you know, we are seeing a renaissance in rug hooking, and it's going to be slow going. But we are seeing, I mean, my Facebook group now is I think it's heading toward 22,000. I didn't think there were that many rug hookers out there. So they're there, and they're coming out of the woodwork. You know, they just need permission to play a little bit, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, you gave them a home, and you gave them a home at a time when everybody was looking for something.
Yeah.
And you know, war profiteer. I don't know. You build a place for people to go when they're just sitting there not knowing, you know, not knowing what was going on outside their walls. And a lot to be said for that on the positive side, much more than the negative, I think.
Yeah.
Well, and it's carried. So I know one of my 5,000 hobbies is riding bikes. And during the pandemic, you couldn't buy a bike. I mean, they couldn't keep up with the demand. And now that the pandemic is over, bike shops are just buried in inventory.
Oh, yeah.
Because people went back to their regular lives, and the bikes are sitting in garages, or they just quit buying them. But I think it with needlework, it set up a momentum with textile arts, I should say, to make sure I include everyone. It set up a momentum that I think is still carried through to today, in many ways. It's held up, and it's pretty neat.
It is really neat. And, you know, people historically, everyone says things happen every 30 years, right? Every 30 years, things will come back. And we did see that from like the 1930s to the 1970s. There was a big craft renaissance. And then there was a little pause. It's almost, you know, it's the ebb and the flow of everything in life. There will always be a certain demographic of people who are like, I can buy it. I'm not going to make it, right? And those people are never going to come to any craft.
Right.
And that's okay, right? That's the ebb and the flow, and that's the numbers game. But I think more and more people, as time goes on, that 30-year rule doesn't really apply anymore. I think everybody has a little more free time in general, right? In general, And I think people see crafts, they see lots of different crafts. We get hit in the face with media all day long. We see lots of everything on all of these different sites. And I think people have it in their heads now more than before the computer age. Like, oh, there's lots of things that I would like to learn. There's lots of things I would like to try. And I think as long as that is the mentality, people will, when they feel it, get involved in this craft or that craft. And some people will stick with just one. Some people will dabble and say, I like everything. I don't make me choose, right? I like everything.
Right, right. So,
but there just seems like there's more people doing crafts these days. And I hope that we sustain that level of interest.
Right. No, and I think some of that is people are now at a point where staring at screens all day just has to stop.
Yeah.
And there's nothing productive coming out of that other than if you're staring at a screen for work. What am I doing with my time? When am I going to get something that I have tangible to show? And needlework, textile arts fit that whole thing. Yeah. Talk to me about the art part of it, because your designs are as you just said, are just simple lines that define a space. And so then I assume that when I start to do the hooking, that that's where the art comes in. You have some space, and then that's where the art comes in. Take me through that process. Do you have a vision when you draw these things as to what it could be, or are you just putting down shapes and then let your mind do its thing when you go to a hook?
You know, I do a little bit of both, because at this point, if I didn't have a business, my answer would be different, right? Because when you have a business, you're thinking about what you can sell. And, right. and if you want to keep your business, you're thinking about doing designs that will be have mass appeal. So it part of my life revolves around doing stuff that's seasonal that I think will be appealing to my demographic of person. And I hope to sell stuff. But more and more often, as the business, you know, as the business grows and I write more books and now I'm publishing a magazine, I have a little more sort of room for my style, what I like, and I can deviate much more than I did at the beginning with doing stuff that appeals to me. So that part has changed. For someone coming to the craft for the first time, you could do what people did back in the day and just have a piece of burlap. For example, this is an old rug. It's on a piece of burlap, and it's just a geometric design, right? Mm-hmm. It looks a little bit like a log cabin quilt. And this is a commercial design. It's been printed. You know, you could easily do this with a Sharpie as well. That would work just as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're just filling in all of the lines with your fabrics, right? You're cutting your stuff bit by bit. This is a geometric. So historically, this wouldn't have been like a super, this wouldn't have had a ton of prestige. This would be like a kitchen or upstairs rug. You wouldn't want the neighbors to see this.
Yeah.
But this is a commercial pattern that people could easily execute themselves. This is the polar opposite. This is a rug that I am putting into my book, which will be out in a couple of weeks. It's called The Haunted Rug, and it's an all Halloween book. This is completely the opposite. This is a crazy rug. It's called Hat Head of a Witch. Hope I've got it on camera here.
Yep, I've done it.
It's got a geometric border, but I've done most of it with wool bat. So not even roving, wool bat, just the loose cotton candy stuff. But you can see this is, I mean, it's got a little bit of humor. It's a little bit wacky. It's very different. You know, there's so much in between the traditional and the stuff that I'm doing now. The stuff that I'm doing now, I feel at this point, I've got pretty good traction on the business end of it. Feel pretty confident I'm going to pay the bills on the studio and all my supplies and stuff. And now I'm really feeling the part of it that other people get to feel from the start, where they're working on designs that they love themselves. And some people, I mean, I do a lot of design classes in the brand. I do tons of design classes, but they are for people who want to do their own designs. You don't have to do your own designs. Mm-hmm. And some people, technical people, feel that more like sort of paint by numbery, right? And I'm saying that in a sort of disparaging way, you know, it's like what I love is to get a pattern, choose the pattern, dig in, get all those layers of shading. And then other end of the spectrum, the other creative people will say, you know, what I like is a blank canvas and a Sharpie. And I like to do something exactly my way. And then you end up with designs that are a little bit different. This was on the cover of the first issue of Magpie Times, which came out at the beginning of the year. This is kind of in between, right? It kind of meets in the middle. It's a bit traditional. It's based on the Secret Garden. It's a big rug. And it's got a leafy border that revolves around a keyhole motif. But it's a little bit in the middle. It's not as far out as Hat Head. But so it's, you know, it'll appeal to more people. But as far as, you know, designing, I do a little bit of everything because of the business. And more, I work around book projects. And when I do a book project, like I just finished, I'm just finishing this Halloween book project now. I put out about 140 to 150 original patterns of mine, and people in the group who follow me hooked them. I hooked maybe five, but obviously I'm not going to hook 100 and something
right,
of them.
Right.
So other people hook them. And now we're talking about, you know, heart stuff where it's my designs, but I see the way someone else interpreted
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And that's when it gets really interesting. And that's when we feel so connected, you know, as a community, when you see people hooking the same design in two different ways, different materials, mm-hmm. Interpreting things differently. The only thing the design has to be is appealing and inspiring for the person who's working on it.
Right.
And technically manageable, right? You can't have a super fussy design if you're a beginner. You're setting yourself up for frustration and right. not success.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So then there's really, what I'm hearing, two channels. There's what sells and what people enjoy doing, but then you have this other channel in your head of things that of art that you want to do, and sometimes that's sells well, and sometimes it doesn't, but you don't worry about that because it's what you want to do for you.
Yeah. It is. At this point, I feel like I do have enough. I have a little free time, not much, but I have enough free time.
Okay.
For example, like one of my friends who's in the group, she's working on a book that my brand will end up publishing. And it's just about what we were talking about at the beginning about mental health. And she comes from a military background, and she's worked out some stuff with rug hooking. And she's asking a bunch of other people who have had problems with depression and health problems, physical problems, to contribute a piece to that book. So, for example, the piece I'm putting in that book is called Dumpster Fire, and it's a hooked rug of a dumpster fire with this beautiful rainbow coming out. Now, I won't put that out as a commercial pattern because I know that's not for everybody.
Right, right.
But a good example of something that was healthy and cathartic for me to make without thinking about it being commercially viable, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you're not, I mean, we've talked to several designers who do that same thing, no matter what the technique. They'll put out kits or designs that that they know will sell or think will sell, but they're also designed so that they're approachable to the largest mm-hmm. group of people. But then they have some of their own work that they know the majority of people would just never do because it's too technical, too difficult, too whatever it is.
Yeah.
But it also is just something that they just like.
Yeah.
And sometimes they'll put it out and it'll catch on, and other times it just crickets, but doesn't matter because because at some point I'm sure you just simply have to express your art no matter what it is.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there is a real distinction in rug hooking. There are two distinct paths. It's like Robert Frost, like two roads diverged. We're seeing this in a really pronounced way right now. We're seeing a real offshoot of rug hooking that is like the gallery artists. So we are seeing for the first time like a really steady wave of rug hookers and punchers who are making rugs, tapestries that are gallery art, right? And they're challenging or they're themey. And you're seeing them in galleries and they're priced that way. Mm-hmm. That is one offshoot of rug hooking. That's not that's great, right? I'm so happy that there are people there filling that spot to showcase the craft. My place is definitely in teaching, writing, the history, and being a cheerleader for people who are coming to the craft. But both ways are right. Obviously, one is not, they're both trodden equally the same, and they're both fantastic mm-hmm. ways. But people who lean toward gallery art, they're doing very different kinds of motifs and work than you would see me doing at my brand.
Yeah.
You know, even my own work, it's even outside of that. It's like, it's another level, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I wondered about that. That was one thing I wanted to explore with you is there that level with rug hooking? And I've seen punch needle that is kind of mind blowing. So there is that whole channel of this isn't the right term, but higher end art, gallery art, that there is that channel. Yeah. But the majority of people are doing what I would do.
You know, that's a tough question, because like with all art, right, some of the stuff that I see that is rug hooking in galleries, like some, for example, I've seen a show recently, and while it was wonderful and it moved me, it was very naive, right, which it's folk art, right, and rug hooking is folk art.
Oh, okay.
But a beginner could have done any of the rugs, right, mm-hmm. because it was folky and it was naive. So it's not like, I wouldn't say that it would be a drawn conclusion that the best and most technical examples of rug hooking are in galleries. I would say some of them are, but some of what we're seeing in galleries are very folky and naive, just like all art. You go in there and you say, why am I looking at a square of blue? That makes me angry. Why did I pay for this? And then the person standing next to you, who's me, is like, well, that we're not really looking at blue. We're looking at New York in the 1950s, and we're hearing jazz music, and we're picturing studios. Right. So it's very subjective, just like all art. And I wouldn't say that the best is in galleries. I would say the people who are interested in selling, their work is in galleries. But some of the best of what I've seen is at home on the walls, right, on the bedroom walls of people who are not interested in that route.
Yeah, okay. So I could go to a gallery and see something and go, wow, I could do that. Yeah,
And you could do that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. So talk about these things in terms of very few are actually rugs, that most of it is some kind of a hang-on-the-wall tapestry or table top or mm-hmm. something like that. Is that how we play it?
It is, just because in terms of dimensions, right? I mean, rug hookers often like to work constantly. You're always working on some project. You can't always do rugs that size. It's overwhelming. It's a space, a question of space. It just doesn't make any sense. You know, most people work on a much smaller frame. They're doing smaller pieces. Some people insist on the thrifty sort of utilitarian roots of the craft, and they can't justify doing a piece unless it's on the floor or it becomes a pillow or something like that. Mm-hmm. But most people, you know, it's about beauty. It's about doing small pieces and then another one and then another one. So we are, it would be wonderful to be able to shift language and say, like, you know, start saying tapestry, start using different words to describe what this craft is so that it was more accurate. But it's hard to shift gears when people have been saying rug hooking since the 1860s.
Right.
So we subtly try to change words here and there and get on board with each other, leaders in the industry, so that we create language that says to people, come and do this. We're not talking about something that's 8 foot by 10 foot. We're talking about something that's 12 inches by 12 inches.
Right.
You know,
right. Yeah.
Bit by bit. Yeah. We're just, you lead by example. You try to show things that are smaller and more manageable and approachable, you know, because I mean, there's a lot of people who come to the craft and say, I'm doing this in my retirement. I honestly won't finish that piece before I die. Right. Like it's for the breakers, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. No, that's the terminology is it does kind of get in the way because punch needle is what I have most exposure to. And even that term is like, that seems just really kind of crude and primitive. And then when you see what talented punch needle people can do, your jaw drops. It's just amazing what people can do with such a simple technique. But oh boy, when they start doing different levels it's gorgeous. Yeah. It's gorgeous work.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. And the punch needle has struggled a lot because it came into the world in the 19th century being called a rug making machine. And it was like a shuttle, like a two-part shuttle that went like this, that had like two, you know, and it was, I mean, you really needed to be an Olympian to where it's hard, right? It's very physically taxing. And then it shifted gears and it started to look more like a modern tufting gun. But it still worked the same way from reverse. You're pushing loops down. Mm-hmm. But the punch needle, even more than the rug hook, has had a real journey in terms of what it's been called, so many different things over time. It's very confusing to people, you know, what punch needle is, what it does. Additionally, because now there's a craft called miniature punch, which is also known as Russian punch, and that works the same way with a needle in reverse, but it's miniature. You're doing pieces that are like teeny, 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 teeny.
Oh.
So also punch needle, right? So there is a real problem with language with this craft.
Yeah. Wow. So for you, does one technique over the other for a design? So like, you know, I've got this design. This has to be punch needle. I have this other design. It has to be rug hooking. Do you go through that mental process?
Not really. I mean, the only reason I would go, I love rug hooking. I also love punching, but I typically would go because while I am not technical, I am a bit of a control freak. And I do really distract myself when I do punch needle because I'm seeing the reverse of it. Now, some people these days punch in reverse and then they prefer the reverse side as the finish side. We would call that the wrong side or the back side. Oh. Now people are saying, oh, I prefer this side. And why shouldn't I? So, you know, for me, I prefer the side with the loops. I prefer work that has some kind of height and pile. And it drives me a little crazy with punch needle that I can't exactly see what's happening and I keep wanting to flip the work over. That's being controlling and that's something that's built into me, but obviously not everybody has that. Right. And other people are fine watching the Hallmark Channel and boop, 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 yep. boop, boop, and they flip it over and it's like, great, you know? Yeah. So I tend to always reach for my hook. And, you know, using a hook gives me more. When you use a punch needle, I don't have one with me. I should have thought to grab one, but it looks similar, but it has a shaft, right? It has a tip on the end and you put your material, which is usually yarn, through the shaft and punch, 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 punch. So you can only use fiber that won't get stuck and snag in the shaft, right? Because then it won't make the loops or they won't be even. With rug hooking, if you've got your backing laid out, whatever you chose, right, and you don't even have to choose one I mentioned, you could find anything that is a woven, right? Anything that's a woven. And hey, if you can pull up loops, then you can use it. You don't have to use one of the traditional rug hooking backings. You can hook into a piece of wool, right? It works great too. I can pull up anything that I can fit in my hook, pulls up to the surface without too much grief and aggravation, is going to work. Mm-hmm. So for example, with rug hooking, I can use my cut up material. I can cut up my clothing. I can cut up pieces of wool, right, which is traditional milled wool.
Yeah.
Cut it up strips with my expensive machine. Or I use my scissors, right, when I'm not making stuff for other people. I just use my scissors or my rotary cutter. But with punch needle, right, I wouldn't want to use a strip of wool. You can, but I wouldn't want to, because how long could that strip of wool be?
Yeah,
and I punch, and then I'm rethreading the thing, right?
Constantly.
And
for me, constantly.
Yeah, that would, some people are like, no problem. I can thread it 400 times in an hour. No problem. For me, it would drive me nuts. So I like things that are like yarn and I've got them already rolled into a cake. And with things like this, like for example, with this yarn, I like, it's got a very nubby texture to it. This wouldn't be good in a punch needle because it would snag every time it hit one of these sort of balls, right? Mm-hmm. I couldn't hook novelty fabric, yarn, eyelash yarn, ladder yarn. Those things would probably, not 100%, you'd have to try, but they'd probably snag in a punch. I like to hook with mohair, tiny balls of mohair, and lace yarn, things like that. And this is the stuff I was talking about earlier, bat, right? This is just bat. It's wool that hasn't been spun yet. Right. That is like cotton candy. I pull a piece off and I say, oh, good. I wanted the orange part. And I hook with it just like this. And this would never go through a punch needle. So while I love punch needle for speed, and I'll often punch the whole background of a piece for speed, and then I'll flip it over, right, because it's reversed. And then I'll hook the rest of it because I want a little bit more detail and I want a little bit more choice as far as the materials that I can use.
Yeah.
Everybody's different. And most rug hookers in general, I would say, do a little bit of punch, do a little bit of latch, a little bit of rug hooking, a little bit of Rhea rug, which is a needle rug making thing that's similar in look to latch hook, but it's done with a needle. There's all kinds of sort of varieties, brothers, sisters, mutations, and hybrids of rug making that you could really all use in the same piece.
A whole world there. Wow. Didn't realize. Didn't realize.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So talk about your business now. Do you provide kits? Do you fabric? I assume you have tools that people can buy. What is Ribbon Candy Hooking provide?
So I have all the things you mentioned. I have basic hooks in three sizes, right? Hooks are not standardized, but I really only use two sizes, medium and then a larger hook. I think everything else is just, you know, you buy anything you want, but you don't need it and you're not going to use it. So I sell three sizes of hooks, which is, I think, one too many. I sell the different backings that are traditional rug hooking backings. I sell some kits. I sell wool that I dye. I dye tons of wool. You know, it really depends on what's out at the moment. My focus with the business, while I sell all of those basic supplies, I sell patterns just on backing for people who already have the supplies, or they say, I'm going to use my yarn. I'm going to cut up my jacket. I want your pattern, right? Because I don't design stuff, right? I just like the design, but yeah. I've already got my own stuff. I've been hoarding for years. I'm a quilter. I'm going to use my quilt fabric to hook with. So just send me the pattern. I do that too. But mostly right now, more than anything, I've been publishing books. I'm going to start publishing other people's books too. And I've been publishing Rug Cooking / Fiber Arts magazine as of this year. So publishing is a big part of Ribbon Candy Hooking right now. And while I will never let go of the practical part of it, so people, you know, if they know me and they found my videos and they come to the craft through me, I'll get them going with the basic supplies. Yeah. But my personal emphasis at this point is on publishing, because I feel like between my YouTube channel and books and magazines, I can reach a lot more people and show them a lot more examples of variety.
Yeah.
So that's right. Kind of
so, what I'm so at. That helps me now, because I picked out the two books that you have, but I did not realize that magazine was yours. I thought that was someone else and you were just contributing to it. So you started this magazine. This is pretty neat.
Well, Rug Hooking Magazine has been around since like the 70s, 80s, but my magazine is called Magpie Times.
Right.
So we have three. It's a quarterly, and it's available at Ribbon Candy Hooking. But I also made it available on Amazon because people were buying it in Canada, in Australia, and the shipping was like four times more than the magazine.
Right.
So we put it into Amazon, and you know, people can look at it on their Kindle. If they have Prime, it comes the next day. But the main thing about Magpie Times is it's emphasis on rug hooking, but it's all fiber arts. And I'm always asking people to contribute stuff to it, not just rug hooking, but other fiber examples of fiber art, contribute articles, contribute items for the gallery, single pictures for the gallery, contribute tips, right? Anything you like that you think other people would be interested in, because it's a quarterly, it's themed kind of seasonally. So we're heading into the winter issue now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I do a little bit of the writing for it and I'm kind of pulling back. It's not a me show. It's not me and more me. I'll always put a little bit in there because it's my magazine and it's a token. I publish it with Judy Taylor, who's another rug hooking artist, and she's published tons of books, over her career. And we're always looking for other people to contribute stuff because we want lots of examples, lots of hands, lots of voices, lots of different aesthetics, lots of different tips and techniques. We want variety. So I'm always saying send.
Yeah.
I always want to celebrate other people's work.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
I may have to get a copy. I'm a magazine editor, 45 years of magazine editing. So I hone right in on magazines immediately.
Oh,
so,
great.
Yeah. So I'll have to get a copy of that. And then we have two books, Design Like an Artist and Handmade Rag Rugs coming up. Is that coming up or is that out?
No, that was the first one. That was 2 years ago. That was published by Fox Chapel.
Okay, nice piece of research on my end. Yes.
No. I mean, hey, you know, I have so much stuff out there. It's all crazy. But no, they asked me to do that book. And that was it's a very comprehensive book about, I think, I mean, they edited it heavily. Originally, there was about 20 different rug making techniques in it. I think there's maybe 15 or 16 after editing. It's already a very thick book, so they had to kind of cull. But it's many different techniques for rug making. And it was really the vision of the publisher and the editor. It's a great book. It's a great approach to any kind of rug making. It's going to be in that book. Mm-hmm. So that was my first book. And then the second book, I was approached by Rug Cooking Magazine. And I really was not looking to work. I was looking to start doing my own editing and my own stuff altogether. But I have such a good relationship with Rug Cooking Magazine, and I've contributed articles and, you know, and I like to be a team player when I can. So I ended up doing the Design Like book because it was based on a series of classes that I'd been giving for a couple of years. And I had already done so much of the writing and the research. It was very sort of easy for me to put it together at that point. Mm-hmm. So that was the second book. And now the third book is coming out. We'll be starting to print it within the week. And it'll come right around. It'll be out probably the week before Halloween. And it's called The Haunted Rug. It's an all Halloween book. And I wouldn't say Halloween is my favorite holiday, but it's right up there with Christmas. And I've noticed as a business person at Ribbon Candy Hooking, I've noticed that Halloween outsells Christmas, at least at Ribbon Candy Hooking, about 10 to 1. I mean, people love Halloween and fall. And there isn't a book that is just patterns mm-hmm. for Halloween and fall. So I thought, I better fill this gap before someone else realizes that there's not a book out there. So that one's coming out very soon.
Okay. All right. So you enjoy, obviously you enjoy publishing or have come to enjoy it. You like assembling all that and putting together a concept and.
I do. I have kind of like a collector's mind. Like, you know, I come to the craft and I think back, and I don't mean to be negative thinking about the 20th century, but rug hooking in my mind kind of stagnated during that time. There wasn't a huge amount of variety and there wasn't a huge amount of originality. And now we're hitting a time where it's like, I'm looking around at other artists and saying, whoa, how did you do that? Is that rug hooking? And I'm seeing so many people who have quietly on their own been evolving different styles and developing themes. And every time I see someone new, I think, oh my God, you should have a book. You should put that into a book because we all want to see that.
Right.
So this has happened so many times that I thought, you know what, I'm going to start handling my own books because the magazine is working out and it was easier than I thought to sort of figure it out. And using, I mean, the base that I have, the Facebook group, which is called Rug Cooking and Punched Needle Club, I don't want to brag, but it is the largest rug cooking group. And there's a lot of people in there. And when you shoot the word out to people, hey, does anybody have something that fits that? Does anybody have anything with snowmen? Does anybody have, you know, things with vases or copies of antique rugs or whatever? People jump in and they say, oh, I do. And I would love to be part of it. So when you have a big base group like this, I don't have to do all the work. I keep reaching out to people and saying, come on, give me your work. You be part of it too. And it makes projects faster and easier to turn over. It makes it possible to publish the magazine and be working on all these different book projects. But at the end of the day, we are a tiny craft. You know, there is one rug hooker to about every 280 quilters. That's not good. Yeah. So I feel like, hey, if we flood the market with periodicals for the next few years, we might slowly creep up and become more visible as a craft, as I feel we deserve to.
Yeah.
So I'm going to push as hard as I can to do that with the platform that I have.
Yeah. Yeah, hard to get in the stadiums with knitting and quilting. Those are beasts. Beasts. Yeah.
That's it. They
All right. So how do people interact with Ribbon Candy Hooking? We can get supplies from you. We can get kits and designs, and we have magazine, books, and then classes.
Yep, I have tons of classes online. I teach often in person too. I've got like 8 dates coming up in the next 3 weeks. I'm in Connecticut, so I'm often speaking and teaching in New England and the tri-state area. But in February I was out in Colorado. I just came from Canada. I do other, you know, when people ask me to speak or to teach, I'm there. I'm out there with a regular in-person teaching thing, but I teach often online as well. So all of this, I mean, I have my website is Ribbon Candy Hooking. My YouTube channel is also called Ribbon Candy Hooking. And my Facebook page, weirdly and more generally, is called Rug Cooking and Punch Needle Club. buy ribbon candy hooking. In all of those places, I'm always updating people and saying, shout out for Magpie Times, send me your winter stuff, or hey, I will be at this place this weekend. There's still seats, or it's not that, you know, it's not a class, it's a talk. You can come and whatever. I have my book party coming up when I launch The Haunted Rug in the Berkshires on October 20th. There's tons of people coming to that. So I always have it on my website where I will appear in person. And so that's always there at Ribbon Candy Hooking. But if you follow on Facebook or you watch my shows, I'm only doing two shows a week until November because I'm trying to catch up with this book project. But I'm always on Eastern time at 11 to 12 on Mondays. And then I do what's called cocktail time on Friday night for 2 hours between 7 and 9. And I will be talking about rug hooking, looking at rugs, specific subject, maybe looking at a new book. On this coming Friday, I will be reviewing an event. It's called Tigger. It's one of the three big, one of the holy trinity of organizations for rug hookers. And I just attended that and came home late last night from that in Canada. I'm also the new president of that. So that is exciting. I was just announced as the new president. So you will see me popping up all over the place. And if you're interested, if one is interested in anything that I'm doing, you want to get involved in a project, you have a great book idea, you did a piece that you'd like for other people to see. I do a show once a month. It's always on a Friday called Gallery Night. And people send in their work. Sometimes beginners send their first rug. Sometimes people send photographs of something they're working on, they're stuck on, can't figure out what's going on with color. I'm about to set it on fire. Does anybody have any ideas? Uh-huh. And we look at all of it, you know. On gallery nights, I'm on for at least 2 hours. It's a long show, sometimes more like three. And we're looking at the work of people. And I'm always saying, don't just send it if you think you're an expert. Send it if you're just starting, right? Any rug that you show me, if there's something really obvious about it that's technically not perfect or design-wise not perfect, you can be sure that is the one thing I will not mention live. Yeah, I will talk about the thousand other things that are wonderful about that piece, and it's always easy to find those things.
Yeah, yeah. And all this occurs on YouTube?
That's where we get it. Yep, I have at least 1,000, if not 2. Yeah. Well, 2 videos and live videos, so you can visit them by subject. Some people binge watch the live videos, you know, and the same people often log on, and we have a great sort of community where we like know each other at least through the computer.
Right, right.
So I'm always there live for that group of people, but then I have like hundreds and hundreds, if not over 1,000, how-to videos that are like, you know, an hour and a half long, look at my hands, do this thing, right in great detail. So I try not to put anything behind a paywall. The only thing I put behind paywalls are specific classes, because of course I have to make money too. But 99.99% of my videos are not behind a paywall. Yeah. People can come to them, watch, feast, look, learn, and decide whether they like the craft or solve their problems by watching videos, you know?
Yeah, I went to the YouTube channel, and I did not have a lot of time, and I just had to put it aside because I could just see I was just going to get inhaled into that thing, and hours would go by. Yeah, there's a lot there. It's
Well, thank you. I'm glad it looks appealing.
Yeah. Oh no, I'll be back. But yeah, at that very moment, it was like, no, don't do that.
Oh, it's an awful rabbit hole if you haven't been there before and you're interested at all in fiber. It can't be an awful rabbit hole, but it will be there. It's there any time when it's quiet, you know.
Yep. Well, I'll find it. I'll be back. All right, Deanna, thank you so much. Ribboncandyhooking.com is the website. Mm-hmm. That's where it all starts, and you branch out from there. The Facebook group, obviously huge. What a world. Thanks for sharing it with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. So much fun. Thanks, Gary.
Thanks to everyone for listening, too.